Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining Sober Indian Wednesday Night Live. My name is Karen. I'm your host. And tonight we have Dawn coming on to talk about her journey. Hi, Dawn. How are you doing?
Hi. How are you?
Doing pretty good. Thank you. I wanted to start with having you tell everybody just a little bit about yourself, and then we can go into your journey.
Okay. My name is Dawn D. And today is my birthday. Today it makes the 44th time, or the beginning of the 44th time around the sun. I'm from Oklahoma. I was born in Colorado, but I was been raised in Oklahoma. And, had a pretty wild life, but everything's working out now, thank God.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I know normally we kind of jump straight into it with your journey from the addiction to sobriety. So whenever you're ready to start, we can go ahead and get into that.
Okay. So my name is Dawn, and I am Shawnee, Delaware, sister to Wahpeton, and a whole bunch of other things. No, not really. Not a whole bunch of other things, but a few other things. And one of those is an alcoholic addict. And my alcoholism has led to several addictions. And I'm grateful to announce that I'm celebrating my 5 years free, clean from alcoholism and addiction.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I started drinking when I was in high school. And then, it was a cool thing to do, you know, at the time. And it was what being Indian was, you know. That's how I was taught, because all the ones that came before me and that were in my life, they were drinking. And you know, I just thought that was just the way that we were supposed to do. And although at the same time, with you know, as a child, and experiencing intergenerational trauma, I found myself running away at the age of 16, only to find myself perpetuating the very thing that I ran away from, you know, that party lifestyle. And, you know, I didn't know about the harmful effects of alcohol and drugs. I just knew that it made me feel good, and it made me not feel, you know, all the feelings that I had felt, you know, growing up. I could actually escape from those feelings, and I think that's what really made me addicted to the substance use, you know. But it wasn't just the substance abuse that I really suffered from and struggled with. It was the desire to be, I don't know, I think there was like a spirit of perversion, that everything that I thought was perverse, it was a form of what really was, and it was completely different. My interpretation of life was always skewed. So I ended up getting into a relationship at the age of 17 with a man that was 24. And I had twins with him. He was an abusive partner. And 4 years later, after back surgery and several other things, but very terrible experiences, there was more trauma to add to my list of woes to escape from. So, you know, what I thought out at first ended up being, you know, more load to carry. So I made the painful and very dangerous decision to leave him with my twins, who were both in diapers at the time, and I started working at the Creek Nation Tulsa Bingo. And that just wasn't, you know, taking care of twins, and I was helping my sister. She was pregnant with my niece, and she had a little son. So I'm taking care of three babies in diapers, and it just wasn't cutting it. And so before I really, really thought about things, I was desperate, and I found myself working two jobs, and it was probably a very bad situation, but I let it be as it is. And I was basically selling my body for money on a stage, you know, and looking back at it, I see myself as like a monkey, you know. But anyway, I had to, you know, it's definitely symbolic of us addicts and alcoholics doing what we have to do to survive, you know. And I learned a very important lesson that a mother will go to any lengths to protect her child or take care of her children. At least I did, you know. And they were very detrimental. I made some very bad decisions with the choices of thinking that a party lifestyle could help me raise children. I don't know. I was young, you know. But anyway, so I got out of that situation, and I got my life together, started going to church and doing all of this stuff, you know, that I felt like was getting away from that lifestyle, you know. And so then I got in another jam, and I don't even exactly remember. It's not even important what that jam was, but I made another wrong decision to sell methamphetamine. And I had done it. There was a purpose for it. But by the time that I got busted in 2003, the only purpose was for me to hit that bottom and seek recovery. And that's what happened. I was grateful for a group of friends, a group called Friends and Skins, I think it was, up in Tulsa. And that's where I really got a good dose, for a two-year dose of sobriety. Wellbriety, I should say. I was asked to organize an event down in Glenpool, which was a Wellbriety run. And, you know, I didn't have a clue as to who Don Coyes was at the time. I didn't have a clue as to who I was at the time. But anyway, I'll never forget that day when the event came, and I got to hold that sacred hoop. I've 100 eagle feathers, got to run with that, you know, and I didn't even know the significance of that at the time. But so I got that experience, but, you know, and I thought that I was cured, right? You know, I thought that, you know, I could go about my business. It was like a class that you just pass and then you go on, you know. And I thought that, okay, well, I got this under my belt. I'm going to go on. And I decided that the next best move for me would be to move to Tahlequah and go to school so I could get that little piece of paper that says that I'm qualified to do what I do, you know. And so I moved to Tahlequah. And that's when the party really started. And, you know, looking back in my mind, I always wanted that college experience, but I felt like I couldn't get it because I had children, you know, and then the college experience happens, and then it's ladies' night, and it's this, and it's that, you know. And, you know, before I know it, I remember celebrating my 30th birthday in a local bar around here, you know, and I was looking at that picture not too long ago And I was just thinking, poor girl, little do you know that in these next 14 years, you're going to go through a great metamorphosis, you know? And so I got an issue with my thyroid, and I started getting goiters, and people started saying, hey, you need to go get that checked out. Well, you know, I mean, it was the same kind of deal, like with my drugs and alcohol. You know, people would make these mentions, no, I'm okay, I can do this. You know how we are. And that's the way I was with my thyroid, you know, and I thought that I could make it go away. I thought my prayers were strong enough, even though I was using and everything, carrying on the way I was. I put it off for 2 years before I got treatment and was probably just about dead. But my answer, one of the things about the thyroid is that, you know, it's your endocrine system and it messes with your whole chemical balance. And, you know, I got to where I couldn't even carry a laundry basket. So instead of going and getting treatment, I mean, you know, going to the hospital to get treatment and get it fixed, you know, my answer was, let me do some meth, and then that way I'll be as strong as I want to be, you know. And it wasn't long after that, and I don't even remember when. I don't even remember when the first time I started using a needle. But I can't believe, I remember one time, I was just looking down at myself, and I was thinking, how did you slip down this far? You know, there was a time back in 2003, I wouldn't even talk to somebody if they was, you know, a junkie or anything like that, you know. And here I am, powerless, in the grips and throes of this baffling, cunning paralyzation of this addiction that I was in. And, you know, so... Here I am, fast forward, I went from, you know, my last year of school, I had a 3.67 GPA, I was on the Dean's Honor Roll, and then fast forward a couple of years, and now I'm getting a bedroll issued out to me every time I turn around, it seems, you know, and most of the time it was because I failed to appear to court because I was too high, or because I failed to pay my fines because I was using all my money on drugs and alcohol. And it was like no matter how hard I tried, it was never enough. And it just left me in such despair, you know, to where I just didn't care anymore. I didn't care. People left and right, to the left and right of me were dying or going to prison, and it was just like I felt like I was failing at even, you know, trying to get through this life, you know. But I am so super grateful today because I know why I failed. I was failed because I'm supposed to be alive. And as much as it's funny for me to think about, it was just so monumental when the day came that I joined the longest walk. But before that, I left fleeing for my life from this town that I was raised, this town that I had developed such a rap sheet in. And I had left, and I had went, I just had a grandson. You know, I think about this, and I think about, you know, I never really saw what having a good mother was like, you know, one who wasn't an alcoholic and one who was there for me and caring and supportive and stuff like that, you know. So I didn't know how to be that, but I did my best. But then when my grandson was born, I'll never forget the day I first held him. I mean, I saw him born, but I didn't get to spend time with him. The first time I got to hold him, just him and me, I could tell he was giving me a message like sign language. He was telling me, like, he just came straight from God with a message for me. And I'm telling you, it was the first time I cried out, saying, God, please let my heart understand what he's telling me. So anyway, you know, within a few months, I'm down where he lives in Norman with my daughter, and I go to see him for a couple weeks, and I just fell in love, because while I didn't have a mother figure that I got what I needed from, or I got what I needed, I did have a grandmother who gave me everything I needed, and I did know exactly how to be a grandmother. And so we were supposed to just go see him for a couple weeks, we ended up staying. And that would be the last time that I would ever, like when we left and I got there to Norman, would be the last time that I would ever use a needle and desecrate my body the way that I had been doing. But so then that was in September of 2016. In fact, it was the fourth blood moon that happened. It was pretty crazy looking back at all of this and seeing the significance of time. But then, my daughter, she was pregnant with my second grandson, and he was born on March 1st, and my first grandson was born on March 10th. So my second grandson was born on March 1st, and he lived to be 19 days old. He got to hold. I was the official burper of the house, you know, Coco, Grandma, you know. Anyway, that 19th day, there was just something in me that just felt like there was a spirit telling me to somehow prepare myself. And the only thing I knew how to do was sing this Muscogee Creek hymn, is translated in Hallelujah. But I went to a spiritual authority conference that afternoon that I had been planning to go to for months. And my daughter, she called me screaming. And she said, Mom, he's dead. And so, I felt real humbled and but I felt I had to stay strong, you know, because of my daughter and my son-in-law. And we got through that. Well, this AIM sister of mine, Belva Janice, rest in peace, I was put in touch with her, and I told her, you know, here I am. I really don't know what to do here, because I feel myself wanting to cope some way, and I only know one way to cope. As I hear this longest walk is coming through here, I hear that that is for people like me. And she talked to me and she said, I think you should join that walk. You know, I've never been on a walk or anything else. It's been a long time since I've done anything for anything, any good purpose, you know. So my partner and I, we packed a suitcase and we made our way to join the walk in Tulsa. So that is why, even though I actually made the decision to quit drinking that weekend before, but we joined the walk on the 24th, I wanted to always remember I wanted that to be my sobriety date, because I wanted it to be significant as the start of my Red Road journey, you know. So we started that walk, and the first day we joined, gosh, a tornado came through and blew our tent away. It was like every force of heck came against us, tried to get us off. You know, my daughter, she went back to using. She was, her doctor prescribed her with Xanax. And that was in my opinion, was the worst thing that she could have ever taken, because, you know, I could see she was like a zombie, and, you know, but I think it was a good experience, because I, for the first time, was able to see myself in her and what I had done all these years, you know, and that she had to watch me be like, you know. And so, and then we walked, and let me tell you, it was nothing short of just a commitment calling this in at that first walk was declaring war on drugs and domestic violence. And, you know, I walked many miles, many steps in prayer, thinking about my daughter, thinking about myself. You know, and that was all I could really think of. I was thinking about my loss, my losses, my failures, stuff like that, you know. And it took me, you know, we went the southern route. So we went through Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia. Well, we even went to Florida. And then we started going up the East Coast. And it took us to get into South Carolina before that hard edge exterior started coming off on me where I could kind of start crying a little bit, you know. But it was really when we got to Healing Springs, South Carolina, that this water, you know, this place, this Healing Springs, and the people come from all over the world to collect water from this place. And this, it was a really beautiful place. And Dennis Banks, he played a healing song, and I mean, I just couldn't help fall, just cry. And normally I had this real big problem about crying in front of others, you know, up to that time, you know, and something broke in me, something changed in me, but all I know is that after that, that walk started becoming for other people. I remember that a Shawnee sister of mine, she lost her sister, her older sister. She was really, really mourning that loss. That whole family was, you know. And I called her and I told her, I said, I'm going to walk today for you, walk for your healing, you know. I'm grateful today that, you know, the last Lobiety gathering last season, I saw her and she's still going strong and everything like that, you know. But there was a lot of sacrifice in dying to myself. And by the time that we got to Washington, D.C. and walked on the Lincoln Memorial, I tried my best not to let my trembles be noticeable, but I was trembling on the inside. I felt so much power. I felt so much redemption. I felt like we made it. I remember when we were in Ainer, South Carolina, Dennis Banks, he said, you know, we were all, you know, a bunch of alcoholics, addicts, right? We were all not getting along, and this is going on, and that's going on. And I can't tell you how many times my flesh wanted to get off the watch, but, you know, he gave us this speech, and he said, you know, some of you aren't going to make it all the way. Some of you might. And for maybe a couple of you, this walk will never end. Man, I remember going from like just fantasizing about death to this little girl inside me leaping, just the inner child in me saying, please take me. I want to be the one that this walk never ends. I never want to end this walk. Even though it was hard, even though, gosh, you know, our tents were getting blown around, or we were sweating, you know, or didn't have showers for days, you know. I mean, I would think about that stuff and want to complain. And I'm like, oh, come on, girl, how many days you've been high? Didn't even know how many days you've gone by. You just need to just suck it up and keep on walking, you know. And so looking back, you know, we finished that walk on July 15th, 2016. It would be the last walk that Dennis Banks ever led. So I feel a lot of honor today because of that leadership, you know. And so then, you know, I had never been a political person or anything like that. I wasn't into any kind of thing except for drugs and alcohol, really. But we ended up walking at Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and this is my homelands, my Delaware homelands, my Lenape homelands, and we stayed in the Blackbird State Forest under those same trees, and just the connection. I have never had in my life an experience. When we were in Pennsylvania, we slept on the riverbank there, probably illegally, but we couldn't find, because of that, there was the Democratic National Convention was there, and we were protesting it. And we stay there, and I learned so much. And you know, I learned the most, and that stays with me today, is not what everybody else did, but how important our connection to this land is, and that the sicker the land is, the sicker the people get. I got back from the longest walk, and I was home a few months before Standing Rock, you know, and I worked 24/7 around the clock getting people there, you know, helping with supplies, all that I could, you know. And then on November 5th, a group of us went up there, and we ended up building the Long Walker Lodge. And we were greeted by a Hunk Papa elder, and right past the Mo Bridge. I can't think of right now what that area is called. But anyway, so he told us, he said, you know, you're welcome to be here, but remember, you're not here to get popular. You know, you're not here to get Facebook famous, and you're not here to, you know, cause trouble. Not here to, you know, carry on. You're here, if you go to that front line, you stand there and you stand still as a stone. You pray. And I remembered that when we got there, and all the times that my ego, my old ways that wanted to be in control and stuff, you know, there were people that would approach me and say, hey, you want to run the kitchen? Hey, you want to do this? And my desire, you know, my heart of service, I've always just been, yeah, I do it, you know. And the answer was, I'm here to pray. And that's what I did. I stayed by the Cannonball River, right by where the water ceremonies were held every morning, and got a lot of good medicine, and I had a lot of time to think, you know, I had a lot of time to think and reflect on all the things that happened that on the longest walk, you know, a few months before that, we stayed there until it got way too cold, and we were spitting up blood and stuff. I won't get into the details of that, but we moved into the Cannonball community, where this Standing Rock family, they took us in. They rented us a room, and we were able to stay there and stay out of the elements, which was really cool because, you know, like I said, I'm from Tahlequah, and, you know, we're probably the most colonized Indians around in Turtle Island. So I was learning so much, you know, and when we were on the walk, you know, I'm giving out this information about the statistics of the drug epidemic on the reservations, you know. And here I was, fast forward, on the Standing Rock Reservation in the Cannonball community, and I'm seeing it firsthand. I'm seeing just exactly what I walked for, you know. And I was 39 at that time, and I think today was the day that on my 40th birthday, I was down there in that rented room, and I had just finished a ribbon skirt. I sold four ribbons on it around the bottom, and each of those ribbons represented each decade of my life, you know, and it was all done by hand. And I thought about, and it was nothing like how I think today, but I thought about how far I've come, because I got to be honest, the truth is that whenever I started the walk, I thought, okay, well, I can finish this walk in D.C., and then I'm going to celebrate with a drink, you know. But when Dennis Banks made that speech, and then he even said my name, you know, I felt a huge sense of responsibility that this was going to need to continue. And then next thing I know, the longest walk was extended from, you know, just 2016 to 2020. And so we get back from Standing Rock after being there for 6 months. The longest walk, 5.2, came through, and we were doing the middle of the country this time, the middle route. And they came up to Standing Rock, and they walked us out. We walked out with honor, and it was a good thing. But only I had been without my thyroid medicine for all that time, you know. So I was really sick on the inside. And then plus I had fell at Standing Rock and separated my gluteus maximus. For all those that don't know what that is, it's my butt cheek. Hey. But anyway, so we walked out. We went to the Rosebud reservation, and we walked around those houses that they have there that, oh, just break your heart, you know. And once again, it only more solidified what we walked for on the longest walk when I started this, you know, really driving the nail in the coffin for a relapse, you know, because I was thinking, you know, how could I ever go back to this life that causes this, you know. But anyway, so we moved on from there to the Omahas, and that would be the last time I would ever walk a mile with the longest walk 5, because of that muscle problem, me being sick. It was the most excruciating and most humbling mile I ever walked, because, you know, just 6 months before that, I'm walking, you know, 10 to 15 miles a day, you know, and now I was just struggling just to walk one, you know. And anyway, we ended up coming back, and it was kind of, like I said, it was good for my ego, actually, even though it didn't feel good at the time, because I felt like I let my team down, you know, especially after coming up and to Standing Rock out of the way, you know. So anyway, we get back to Oklahoma, and then my partner, 2 days later, gets a phone call from his mom, and his son had committed suicide. And where we were getting ready to go to our Shawnee ceremonial grounds to celebrate our return, we didn't go at all, you know. And the next 2 years was quite a struggle. The next year was really a struggle because of my partner. He just couldn't accept the reality of the loss of his son, you know. And I was watching that. But even in that, you know, we had a choice that we probably could have used if we wanted to, you know, but, you know, we just both knew that that was not the answer. And as it turns out, the last time, you know, he had a couple of hospital visits, and then his last hospital visit, you know, I finally surrendered. It was, I think it was that Good Friday when he took off. And then I had got the call that next night saying that he had made it into a hospital there. And then so I was relieved to know that he was okay, and I was able to finally surrender. It was the point I'm bringing up about this was because I've always been a codependent. I've always had to have somebody with me. I've always had to have my hand held in order to do anything. And this was the first decision that I decided that I'm going to do this, whether anybody's walking with me or not. And so it just happened to be so that the Trail of Hope Conference in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was going on. And I asked my daughter, I said, will you take me over here and drop me off? This is the place that I spoke at my first 2 years, it was after that White Bison, Wellbriety Run and Powwow and stuff in Glenpool. Then later on that next season when the Trail of Hope conference come, I got to speak at that. So after relapse, after 15 years of relapse, here I go and walk in, and I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed because I fell off. I didn't think that I could, I thought I had graduated, you know, and yet here I walked into a room of the friendly faces that welcomed me the first time. They were still welcoming me, and they were glad that I was there. I was even gifted a T-shirt, and they even let me help out a little bit, you know, but I had made my mind up then. Once again, you know, that this is what's in my future. This is what I want to do. This is the fun that I need to be having because I always feel good afterwards. And I went to that, and then after that, I ended up coming back. My brother called me. And he told me, he said, Dawn, I can't do this on my own. I need help. And I sweared, you know, I swore, I guess I should say, I swore I was never coming back to Tahlequah. But when my brother called me that night and said, I need help, even though I didn't want to, I prayed about it. And then a couple months later, I found myself here in Tahlequah, you know, and I started cleaning up. And, you know, for the longest time, I thought I came back for him. But today, and I recognized this last year, but I recognized that it was Creator who used him to get me to come back here to face these things that I've ran away from not once, not twice, but three times, you know. And so I came back, and I stayed in my room at my dad's, like, all the time, you know. And then my partner, he moved into a position where he, too, started getting to see his kids. And so he started making moves toward independence. And, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I felt like I was, and looking back at it, I was a dry drunk. Even though I had done all these things, I had walked across the United States, went and froze my butt off at Standing Rock, you know, for our water, and, dealt with the situation soberly about the loss of a child and then the loss of a grandchild. You know, I did all that, you know, and I was still miserable, but it was a good elder that asked me, he said, why don't you write a gratitude list? And I got the paper out and pencil out, and I couldn't think of anything I was really grateful for. I think I put God. And then, you know, I'm just like, this is horrible. And normally I would give up, but you know what I did? I Googled it. I said, what are people grateful for, you know? And so I started writing those things down that I recognized on that list. And, you know, I never had a problem writing the gratitude list ever since, you know. And it wasn't because of the fact that I wasn't grateful before, but I wasn't cognitively grateful. And writing that list and being obedient to an elder who asked me to do something for my good, I have yet to see that it not be beneficial for my good. And so it was shortly after that I found myself in the room of recovery again, reconnecting with the steps, reconnecting with, myself, and not denying things, you know, it was only this past season that I accepted that I suffer from dyslexia. That's okay today. Before, I would always deny it, and I just internalized my anger with myself because, you know, simple tasks for others just aren't for me, you know. And, you know, little things like that. I was talking to my son earlier. He called me and told me happy birthday, saying me happy birthday. And, you know, because the Creator and the Spirit is just working through me so much, I was able to say exactly what I needed to say to him about what, you know, making amends, really. And, you know, grateful. I told him, I said, you know, there was a time that I wanted material gifts for my birthday, you know, but all I care about is my connection. And having that, I feel, is the greatest gift I could ever have. So, you know, when my partner and I both hooked up 7 years ago, we were both hopeless addicts. He wasn't so much the alcoholic as I was, but it took him telling me that as soon as that bottle hit your mouth, you turn into a different person. And although I didn't think that was the case, I did recognize that in others. So I kind of had an idea, and I knew that I didn't want to be that. So, you know, that helped me. But the thing that solidified him and I as companions, you know, was the fact that he and I shook hands one Christmas Eve night 7 years ago, and he said, I will help you get your kids back. See, I didn't lose custody of them, just like he didn't. I don't think he did either, but they were out of our lives because we were so unhealthy, you know, and we had no idea. We would, anyway, I won't get into that, but the point is we shook on it, and while we could not commit to each other as a relationship, you know, more than that, we could make that commitment to help each other get our kids back into our lives. And so, you know, here we are 7 years later, and in only five of it sober, you know, coming up five sober. We both have our kids in our lives. You know, we can call any one of our kids and they're going to answer the phone with a loving voice, you know, with forgiveness, you know. And I know it was a large cost to get the sanity I have today. And I'm glad I don't have to do it again. But by God, if I had to, I would, just to not suffer like the way I have the previous 39 years of my life. Well, minus two. So 37 years of my life. So today, you know, I get back and I'm going about, and I'm leading meetings at our local clubhouse here, and you know, I'm staying busy, hooked up with just all kinds of step work and stuff like that. And then COVID comes. I had just got through doing my fourth step with my sponsor. And, you know, we had left off at the fear part. And, oh, my goodness, that fear manifested in ways that I could not believe, that it's really just taken me to now, to where I've been able to walk into meetings without fearing for my life that I'm going to die, you know, because of COVID. You know, it was like a year ago today, there was like, drugs, alcohol, and COVID. I want to stay away from all of them. And unfortunately, that led to me staying in my room, you know, for 3 months. You know, I didn't, and I know everybody kind of did, but, you know, after being so active, you know, I look back at this and I see that Creator is so good to me that he even knows when I need a timeout, you know. I needed a timeout, evidently. I needed a reset to where, you know, after those 3 months, and then I was able to move. I have elder uncle and aunt that live in Texas, and they were needing some help around their house. Well, I get down there and I realize that my aunt overdose from opioids, you know, from a prescription. And I had heard so many stories. By this time, I know all about that too, you know. And so I told my partner, I said, you know, I think we need to stay here a little bit longer and see what we can do, you know, see what can happen. Well, I'm glad to report that her the maid not jumped that far. So this was in July, I believe. And then we gradually started cutting that. They had put her on methadone while she was bedridden, you know. And we started slowly cutting her, weaning her off of it. You know, they said that the dosage of methadone she was taking was equivalent to like 18 Lord tabs, I think. Anyway, it was ridiculous. But so I'm happy to report that, you know, as of Christmas Eve this past year, 2020, was the last time she ever took a methadone. And now she's doing very well. And when I say very well, for a woman who's been laying in bed for the last 10 years, you know. And it's been real good medicine for me to see someone recover, you know, for me to witness someone I love and who used to take care of me recover from this cunning, baffling, powerful disease of addiction, you know. And so I was down there, and I felt like that was good service work, and it would keep me from having to answer to a lot of people of why I'm not around in the rooms and helping out and doing things as I was. And I wouldn't have to worry about catching COVID, you know. And so we've been down there for the past 9 months. And as of last week, you know, I went to my clubhouse a few times, but it was just a couple of times. One time every time I've been back. And I go down and return to Texas, and we follow up on her deal, on her progress, her recovery progress. But when I come up here, you know, I got involved with this with Sober Squad, and my friend Wes, he told me about it. He said you got to see this, what they're doing, you know. And so I looked at it, and it came about in 2017, the best that I have can see. And, you know, that was the year when I walked my last mile, you know, and I, you know, prayed that I could return to the walk. Although my health and, you know, all these circumstances that I was going through just, you know, didn't allow that. And then the 1 year I was ready, COVID happened. So anyway, I know all things work out, and I know that there's a reason for everything, and I'm so glad to be connected, and I'm so glad that, you know, dying today or dying tomorrow is just not an option to me. There's too much to do. Speaking of which, this Saturday, we're going to be hosting our first Sober Squad Oklahoma Spring Gathering, and we're looking forward to different sobriety groups coming down, sobriety groups, we're not particular, coming and joining us. And, you know, we're going to do some fun activities. I got a special elder that's going to be doing a water ceremony and telling us about the gift of water and how it relates to our recovery. And we're going to be making some tobacco prayer ties, teaching, you know, these ways of how we can use our cultural ways to help us stay sober when we pray. You know, we make those prayer ties and hang them up, and we remember our prayers keep us from doing crazy things. But and then also I got some tobacco seed from the longest walk, and I'm looking forward to planting them with everyone when they're here and letting them take their plant home. And hopefully they grow to be big and produce a lot of good medicine, you know. And so, you know, in this very same town that I used to sell drugs, do drugs, you know, I found it really crazy because I came back and all the trap houses I used to go visit are all gone. It is completely gone, annihilated, demolished. Just, And I must mention that yesterday we had a the Peaceful Warrior Way Wobriety Group met, and they meet every Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. And we gathered, we circled up around the drum there, and you know, it was crazy to sit there in that circle at this at, in this field where the trap houses used to be, you know, and it was a pretty cool experience to know that I wasn't the only one that had those former experiences, and then to be, you know, followed by this healing circle, this variety gathering that we all come and been connected to. I can't help feel that we purified that place of ground there, you know, and I'm really grateful for that. So, you know, if I had to say, to sum up my story in a nutshell, I would say this is a life of righting all my wrongs, you know, and I like it. I love my life today, and I'm very grateful for it. I'm grateful for all my elders who have come before me and have taught me what they know and shared their experience, strength, and hope, you know, and I look forward to doing the same, you know, all the days of my life. I pray that the remainder days that I walk around this sun, you know, that I walk the red road in a good way, and leading others, leading by example to show others the way.
Wow, I think that was an amazing journey that you shared with us, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing that with us tonight. I was going to ask you real quick, because we're down to the last 9 minutes.
Okay.
What? Because I know that you're part of Sober Indians, the support group online.
Yes.
When you get on that every morning, how do you view everything? Because I know what I see, and I think it's an amazing group, but I wanted your opinion about the group as well.
Sober Indians was the first sober group that I am aware of at all, that whenever I'm talking about whenever I wasn't sober, I remember seeing Sober Indians, and I really liked that logo that had like that super, you know what I mean? And then to take part of that, to be a part of the group, and all of my elders are in it, you know, I'm just honored that I could be a part of it, because, you know, and the posts, they're inspirational. You know, it's just like, Creator's so big that no matter what I need, I'm going to see. And, you know, I can always count on scrolling through Sober Indians group and being able to see someone sharing something that I need to see and I need to feel, you know, or I need to reply to, respond to. So I'm really, really grateful for Sober Indians, and I'm really thankful for all the admins and everybody that contributes to Sober Indians.
Yeah, I think it's a really great group too, and I love seeing all the support and the encouragement and love that you see every time you get on that page.
It's great.
I really appreciate the fact that you come on and you talked. I know it was emotional. I could hear it. And I just wanted to say thank you for doing that and sharing your journey with everybody. And I hope someone gets something out of it tonight and takes a little bit with them, you know, to know that there is hope out there and there is a way of coming to sobriety. It just takes a little bit of time getting there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is a life filled with being grateful is way worse a life of being hateful, especially to ourselves. And if there is anyone that struggles with being hateful to themselves, I just want to share the message that there is a better way. Being grateful is so much better than being hateful. And, you know, if anyone at all, you know, wants help, there is help available. And the Sober Indians, I can trust that when I share, I'm not going to have to worry about shame. I'm not going to have to worry about being embarrassed to say what I'm feeling on that day. And that's just a wonderful, wonderful platform. I'm so grateful. And I hope that whoever hears this, does get something from it. And the rest just fall away.
Right. Wow. Is there anybody that you want to give a shout out to tonight before we conclude the show?
Sure. I'd like to give a shout out to my family, to Peaceful Warrior Way, to Native Strong Ministries, to Trail of Hope Conference, Sobriety Conference, East Side, and last but not least, Sober Squad in Sober Squad, Oklahoma.
Absolutely beautiful. Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and conclude the show tonight, and I wanted to say thank you once again for coming on and sharing with us. That was an amazing story, a very emotional story, and thank you for doing that. I want to give a shout out to Patrick McCoy for making this show possible, and Sober Indians Online Group. Thank you all for allowing me to be part of the group as well. And I'm going to add one extra because I'm traveling tonight, so I'm going to say give a shout out to Angel from Cricket here in Middlesboro, Kentucky. Thank you for the service for my mother's cell phone tonight. And if anyone's out there listening to it from here, go give this guy a check. Just check it out because he's really great. But definitely go on and check out Sober Indians, the online group, and the groups that you mentioned as well. Because I think the more informed, the better. And I just wanted to wish you a good night. Thank you.
God bless.